Welcome to Inside Medical Malpractice. This subject fascinates everyone everywhere because it affects everyone everywhere. My name is Chris Rokosch. I'm a registered nurse, legal consultant and educator, and the president of Connect Medical Legal Experts. Medical malpractice affects patients, families, nurses, doctors, midwives, healthcare institutions, the associations that define medical standards, lawyers, and the general public. Each month, we'll be looking at the malpractice issues from different perspectives, featuring honest, candid, insightful interviews by people and professionals with a wealth of information to share. Thanks for spending time with me today. Now let's dive into this fascinating subject. Hello, I'm here today once again with Paul Cahill from the law firm of Will Davison in Toronto. Paul's been a partner in that Toronto office since 2001, having started there as an articling student in 2004. His mandate is to help seriously injured people obtain fair compensation for their losses, whether it's from medical malpractice, car accidents, slip and falls, or product failures. He has successfully litigated both jury and non-jury cases in the Superior Court of Justice. He's appeared at both the Divisional and Court of Appeal. He believes that the best outcomes for his clients come from hard work and preparation. Welcome back today, Paul.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, glad to have you here again. This is the second of a series of three podcasts about a triplet set of medical malpractice trials that Paul ran in the past year, two of which we already know are successful, and the third awaiting judgment as of today, which is April 10th, 2020. Just please forgive my small pause there. We were just talking. This is the height of the coronavirus, and I think many of us have kind of lost a little bit of sense of the date and the day that it is, but we are here today. It's Friday. It's Easter long weekend. If you didn't tune into Paul's first podcast, you might not understand the significance of the number three when I say he ran three medical malpractice trials in the past year. Statistically, in our country of Canada, there's only about 60 malpractice trials a year. These are spread out between a lot of lawyers and firms that say their practice includes medical malpractice. And of those 60-some cases that go to trial, in 2018, according to the CMPA stats, only eight of them resulted in a judgment or a win for the plaintiff. So Paul's track record of running three trials is significant. In the past 12 months, is significant. A huge chunk of the trials that went on, and winning two of them is pretty amazing. Congratulations, Paul.
Thank you, Chris.
In the first podcast, you talked about a very sad case where the judgment is still under reserve. It's the Hakopian Estate v. Mahmoud. This involved a diagnosis of abnormal uterine bleeding in a woman in her 50s, a delayed diagnosis of cancer, and later a death from that cancer. I know it's only been a few short days since we last spoke, but any news or updates on the outcome of that trial?
No, we're still waiting for the judgment. I'm checking my emails daily.
Yeah, I bet you are. I'm sure everybody's anxious to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
Well, today, not in any particular order, but today we're going to talk about a trial, and the case was O'Neill-Renouf v. Ibrahim.
Yes.
Why don't you just take it away, tell us about the facts of the case, including the outcome for the plaintiff, and then we'll talk about the trial itself.
Absolutely. So this was a trial that was tried in Toronto. I believe it was in April of last year, April, May of... I have the dates wrong. It was sometime last year. I think it was in the summertime.
We all have the dates wrong right now. We've all forgotten that.
Sometime last year. What it was about, it was a surgical negligence case, and my client underwent something called a tension-free vaginal tape surgery, commonly referred to as a TVT surgery. And the indication for this particular surgery for this patient was urinary incontinence. And what can happen for some women of a certain age and medical history is their urethra can drop a little, causing pressure and urinary incontinence. So the TVT surgery, which is a fairly routine and straightforward surgery, and I'll describe it in a little bit of detail because it's relevant to this case and how it was decided, was performed. And basically what it does is the tape is inserted to kind of gently lift the urethra to alleviate the pressure that was causing the urinary incontinence. So this lady underwent the procedure, and when she woke up, she had excruciating pain. So she woke up in the recovery unit, the post-anesthesia recovery unit, and the first documentation is having a tremendous amount of pain on her right side, I believe it was her right side, sort of in her thigh area. And she was unable to adduct her legs. So she wasn't able to kind of, you know, when you do a jumping jack, she wasn't able to do that motion with her leg on that side.
Like, and moving it away from her body.
Sorry?
She couldn't away from her body? Is that what you're
saying? She couldn't move it away from her body, exactly.
Got it.
And as it turns out, there's really only one nerve that innervates the muscles that allow for this range of motion, and it's the obturator nerve. So it was suspected at the very early beginning that she had suffered an obturator nerve injury as a result of the surgery. And investigations were underway. They did some imaging, some follow-up with neurologists, and no further surgical intervention was done, and no further, you know, diagnosis was made, but that she had some kind of obturator nerve entrapment or injury that ultimately resulted in her having ongoing chronic pain. So the issue in the case, and in this case, much like the Hacopian case, the damages were resolved prior to the trial. So the issue of whether, you know, how much compensation this person should receive if there was negligence proved against the doctor, it was already resolved. So the only issue is whether the doctor fell below the standard of care in performing the surgery, and in so falling below the standard of care, whether he caused the injury to the obturator nerve that resulted in the disability that she suffered from. Now, just backing up a bit in terms of the surgery itself. So the way that the surgery works is it's a blind insertion of a trocar through an incision made in the vaginal wall. And the surgeon effectively runs a trocar that has a sling attached to it through that area up to the base of the abdomen, and then tapes it off there, and then repeats the same on the other side. And it basically, you're threading the tape along, and then you fasten it into place. If you read, upon reading the operative note, and this is, I think, what this case stands for, I think, for an interesting discussion. If you read the operative note, it would seem like a completely ordinary run-of-the-mill surgery. What's interesting is it's a surgery that requires the same thing to be done on each side. So you do something on the left side, you run the trocar through the incision, and you tape it off the appropriate spot, and then you do the same thing on the other side. And reading the operative note, everything was fine. So why did the patient wake up with excruciating pain that clearly pointed to some kind of obturator nerve injury? The obturator nerve lies quite lateral to the surgical area through which the trocar would be positioned. So lateral that the only way to cause some kind of direct injury to that nerve would be for the trocar to deviate laterally in a significant way, which, because it's a blind procedure, if you're inserting the trocar or needle in a way that is at a slight angle off, obviously as it proceeds further along its path, it's going to deviate further and further and further. So the allegation on the part of the plaintiff was the surgeon, he must have lost his bearings, he must have deviated laterally. There's no other way that this obturator nerve could have been injured had he not done so. And to deviate that far laterally in a person with normal anatomy to cause an injury that would be apparent 10 minutes after the procedure ended is below the standard of care. The defense raised an argument, and this, you know, the context of this in the legal sense is how does a plaintiff prove a breach of the standard of care in a surgery when reading the operative note, nothing went wrong? Like, you read the operative note, everything went fine. You put trocars in, you stitched everything up, and it was fine. Nothing went awry. So the plaintiff has to prove that the contemporaneous note made by the operating physician somehow either inaccurate or not complete or not reliable, and infer that there was some kind of negligence not documented based on the outcome. So it's a really kind of a backwards looking perspective to prove negligence, which generally is not the approach that the courts would advocate for when trying to prove a breach of the standard of care. But in surgical cases, the law does allow it where the nature of the injury requires a reasonable inference, or the most likely inference, that it was caused by surgical negligence. In other words, the fact that this patient had an obturator nerve injury, we can infer that the surgeon must have deviated laterally with the placement of the trocar, which is a breach of the standard of care.
Right.
And so that was the gist of the argument. And so what the defense argued was, well, firstly, the operative note says that everything was done normally. So first and foremostly, the court has to accept that the operative note should be the most reliable piece of evidence. And hence, there's no breach of the standard of care, because if you read the operative note, he didn't say that he deviated laterally. He didn't say that there's anything that went wrong. So that's kind of the end of it. But I think the defense had to have some kind of explanation for this obturator nerve injury that was consistent with no negligence. So the defense advanced a theory that, you know, what happened was, you know, the placement of the trocar is, in a way, traumatic, right? It's going through tissue and muscles, and, you know, as it finds its way to its place to tie off the tape. And in so doing, it's going to cause some inflammation or edema. And this edema can travel, and it can track into different parts of the body and cause pressure. And so what must have happened is, despite having done everything right, there must have been some swelling that compressed the nerve so much so that it caused a nerve injury. Only on the one side, right? And that's the other kind of element of this case, is the one of her sides was completely fine, but the other side of her was not fine. So there was somehow swelling on one side that really, you know, really a lot of swelling really quickly, because remember, she was having problems about 10 minutes after, you know, she came, well, immediately after coming out of anesthesia, that there was, you know, a tremendous amount of swelling on one side that immediately compressed the nerve to the point of causing excruciating pain and restricted motion. That was her theory. And, you know, I think I was mentioning in that last podcast, my last podcast, something about common sense, right? And how it's easy to get caught up in some of the medical issues and terms and theories. But when you apply common sense and you have a bilateral surgery where one side is fine and the other side isn't, in terms of outcome, despite the fact that the surgeon may report similarity in approach on both sides, one has to wonder, why is the outcome different on one side and not the other? And even as a layperson, understanding how swelling works, we know that it's not immediate. It isn't just, you know, bang your knee and then, you know, 5 seconds later you have a, you know, huge, massive amount of swelling. It can take hours, days even, for it to reach its apex of swelling. So there was something not very palatable about that argument from a common sense point. But that was certainly what was presented in terms of the explanation for why this happened.
Before we go, before we go any further, I just want to back up to a couple things. Because this is a very common procedure that a lot of women in midlife either have or consider. It's not without its risks, but I guess I'd like to offer two things to anybody listening here that's either had or considering having the TVD done. I mean, the first of it, you know, just this isn't a common scenario, right? I mean, you and I are talking about something outside of the ordinary that resulted in some significant harm. So two things to reassure anybody who's had or considering having. Most of the time, this is a fairly minor and safe procedure. If all had gone well, that's what happened, and she would have likely gone home that same day or not much later than the following day. But yeah. I think this story can also serve as an alert to anyone who does have this in the future or has had it and is suffering some complications that involve any pain away from, you know, the operative area, particularly down a right thigh when you can't abduct your leg. I mean, that's not normal. So just because there's, you know, there's a lot of women in middle age right now with stress incontinence of one level or another. So this is a, you know, highly talked about and sometimes highly advertised procedures, a procedure that's done quite often. So just want to make that one point. But if we could just put a little bit of parameter around your client as well, you know, who we're talking about. Am I right to assume, you know, I just assumed that she's middle-aged, she has stress incontinence, she's maybe had a child or two.
Exactly.
Is that the lead up to the story?
Yeah, absolutely. She was, I think there's no doubt that she was a candidate for the procedure, a good candidate for the procedure. And I mean, this trial, like a lot of medical malpractice trials that I think are advanced in the most efficient way, are very much focused on the issue. And so there was no issue that, you know, she should have had the procedure. There's no issue that the physician was qualified to do the procedure. He had done many of them in his career. You know, the issue was, did something happen in the procedure that fell below the standard of care? And getting back to your point about this being a very safe procedure and this being a very uncommon complication, the fact is, you know, doing literature searches, which lawyers in this area inevitably do, sometimes with the assistance of their consulting physicians, we only found one, maybe two incidences where there was a recorded obturator nerve injury from a placement of a TVT tape. So, and in those cases, it was recognized that the likely mechanics of the injury was due to improper placement of the trocar. So it wasn't something that just happened when everything happened properly. It was iatrogenic. It was caused by the surgeon, which is very rare. Probably wouldn't even be something that you would, or a surgeon would typically warn a patient about because it's so rare.
Right. That's exactly right. Because that was my next question to you. Like the consent or the consent for this procedure, did it include anything that talked about the obturator nerve injury?
Not specifically, but as you know, consents are very broad.
Yes,
in terms of what types of, you know, it can cause. You know, if you're running down, you know, the consent, I mean, it can include death, right? Anytime you have anesthesia, that's on the list. So, yeah, I mean, you could argue from a legal perspective, in terms of whether there was informed consent, you know. There, I think, was some mention of injury to nerves. Was there a specific mention of injury to obturator nerve? I think factually in this case, no. But I don't even think that anyone said that was below the standard of care not to say that, right?
Right.
You wouldn't, I don't think you would expect a surgeon to say, yeah, there's a chance your obturator nerve could be impacted. They would just say, you know, vessel, you know, veins, nerves, arteries, all those sorts of risks.
I've stood at the bedside for thousands of explanations of consents to patients by surgeons. And, you know, I guess it does include everything, bleeding, infection, injury to adjoining organisms, nerve injury, and, you know, death, everything else. And patients almost always sign the consent anyway, because they have, you know, they understand that those risks are relatively low unless it's otherwise stated. And you need the surgery. I mean, you're there at the point where you're in the bed or you're in the doctor's office and you've determined that that's the best path forward. I'm just having a look at the, actual judgment. And this was Justice Baltman. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I'm really struck, you were just talking about the issue, and I'm appreciating very much what you said in the way that this judgment states this. On point six of the introduction, it just very clearly says, I love this, is two sentences that are just as clear as anything. There is no dispute that Ms. O'Neill suffered an obturator nerve injury during the surgery. It is also not disputed that the injury to her obturator nerve is the cause of her damages. Oh, there's three sentences, but this last one says the issue is what caused, and that's underlined, what caused the nerve injury. Very clear that Justice Bultmann understood in the same way that you just described to me, getting to the issue. Also, point 10, you know, to your, you know, to give you a pat on the back, says, I find the plaintiff's theory to be the only reasonable explanation for the injuries. So, interesting.
So I think I think what's interesting about this from a legal perspective is the determination of causation. So the determination of how the obturator nerve was injured was going to be determinative of the standard of care issue.
Right.
And to kind of unpack that a bit, through the evidence, it was accepted by the defense urologist who testified under cross-examination that it would be a breach of the standard of care for a urologist or a surgeon performing a TVT surgery to cause direct injury to the obturator nerve during the surgery. So because that admission was made, and somewhat reluctantly, but the admission was made that, yes, if the obturator nerve was injured in this way, that would be a breach of the standard of care. So then it became an issue in the trial of, well, how did it become injured? Because if it was injured in that way, then the plaintiff has to win, because that means there was a breach of the standard of care.
Right.
And the reason why it's interesting from a legal perspective is, and you, I'm sure you can appreciate this, doing all the case reviews that you do and looking at things, maybe more from a standard of care perspective as a nurse than causation, that often it's standard of care first, and then we look at causation. So was there a breach of the standard of care? Was there a breach? And then if yes, did that breach cause the damages?
Right.
This case went backwards, which is somewhat counterintuitive to the way that we typically analyze these cases. But for this particular case, it was necessary. So we had to determine what was the cause of the obturator nerve injury. Was it the trauma caused by a misplacement of the trocar, or was it an inordinate amount of swelling that was unexpected, even though the trocar was properly placed, but there's so much swelling that it caused compression of the nerve. And if that theory was accepted, the defense theory, then there was no breach of the standard of care, and the plaintiff would not succeed in the case, even though everyone agreed that there was a nerve injury caused from the surgery.
Yes, I can see that.
Right?
So how did you, what was your arguments that convinced the judge? You know, we got the two theories of the injury from the, you know, lateral movement in the trocar or the edema.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, tell me the words and the arguments that you used to convince a judge that your theory was correct.
Just going off the top of my head, I think the three main ones were, one, that this was a bilateral surgery. So the surgeon was supposed to do the same thing on both sides, right?
Yep.
And if we're talking about a general amount of swelling that was caused by the placement of the trocar, you'd expect it to be the same on both sides, right? Like, why would it be a ton of swelling on one side and no swelling on the other? So something different must have happened on the one side than the other.
Yes.
So that was the first argument. The second argument was, this patient came out of anesthesia almost screaming in pain. Right. So it's not like she had a slow burn of pain that developed over 24 hours to the point that it crescendoed into this, you know, problem that got investigated. But she woke up with excruciating pain. And knowing what we know about swelling, and this isn't just common sense, this is what the experts, you know, generally talked about, you would have expected something, you wouldn't have expected such an immediate response absent some kind of direct trauma.
Right.
And not only that, she had mobility issues. So something happened very close in time to cause this, and swelling just didn't quite seem to be the most likely explanation when you think about how it develops versus some kind of direct trauma. And then the third one was going through the medical literature. There were a couple of cases that were reported in the literature of obturator nerve injuries, and in those cases, they were caused by improper placement of the trocar, was what the authors of the studies generally attributed the mechanics of that injury. There wasn't anything in the literature about obturator nerves being caused by edema.
Right.
Nothing.
That is an area of the body that's got a lot of capacity to absorb a lot of edema. You know, think of pregnancies for one thing.
Well, exactly. Well, and so yeah, the urologists and all this, they're saying the pelvis, it's a big space. There's a lot of space in your pelvis.
Yeah.
It's a big space.
And it's not surrounded by bone. Yeah, it's not surrounded by bone like brains and other places like that, right? It's a big
Exactly. And obviously someone who knows anatomy really well would really appreciate that. A judge just sort of being parachuted into it may not appreciate that as much, but certainly when the physicians are generally saying that, I think that's important. But because there was no literature on it, the defense experts couldn't say, well, how much edema is there needed to cause, compression, and how quickly does it develop? Well, I don't know. I mean, as much as it needs, I guess, they might say. But I think the lack of it being a recognized means of injury in the literature, I think also helped dissuade the judge from accepting the defense theory in this case.
Right. And again, for anyone listening, let that also reassure you that this isn't a common outcome for a TVT procedure. So how long, anything else you want to tell us about the trial that was interesting? High point, low point, catastrophic moment?
No, this was a very, straightforward trial. The opposing counsel was very reasonable. We agreed on a lot of things ahead of time. Scheduling was pretty good. Sometimes scheduling can be challenging for lawyers in medical malpractice cases because we have to get physicians in from their busy practices, and they can be reluctant to come. And more or less, to make it long story short, scheduling can be very difficult, which can prolong trials and make people's lives difficult unnecessarily. But the scheduling all kind of worked out really well. It was just a nice, efficient trial that I think lasted about 6 days. So it was good.
6 days. That is relatively short, isn't it? Because they can last weeks, these trials.
Yeah.
And how were you feeling at the end of this trial? Excuse me. Did you have a sense that you'd been successful? And if so, why?
I did feel like I was going to be successful on behalf of my client. I had a good feeling about the case. I felt that the evidence went in well. I found the most challenging expert or the most challenging witness was probably the defense neurologist witness. I found she was, obviously it's always difficult to cross-examine physicians, but this particular physician I felt would throw back medical jargon in my face as I tried to cross-examine her on certain points, which I found challenging to deal with, because sometimes, as much as I may learn something specific in preparation for a case, if we start delving into areas that I'm not that familiar, I have a hard time continuing a cross-examination along that path, so I have to change direction.
Of course.
But apart from that, I felt everything went kind of the way that I had hoped and expected that it would. And by the end of it, based on the judge's demeanor and questioning, I felt optimistic that she was probably going to lean towards the plaintiff's side. But again, you never know until you see the decision.
Yeah, of course. And how long did that take until you got a decision?
So the trial, I'm just looking at the decision now. The trial was in May of 2019, and it looks like the decision was released in July 19th, 2019. So it was just about 2 months. Yeah, it was pretty fast.
That was pretty fast. So describe to me that moment, Paul, for you and your client and her family, when you learned that the judge had ruled in the client's favor in this case. Tell me what that's like.
I mean, it's a great feeling. It's a little less dramatic than jury cases because, you know, in a jury case, you find out right then and there and your client's there and you're in the courtroom and everything. When you find out about a judge alone case, you basically get a fax and it's attached to the PDF and emailed to you. So you see it. And my habit whenever I get judgments is I just scroll right to the bottom. I don't even bother reading anything. I might read the first two paragraphs or three. And usually from that, I know whether I won or lost. You know, just the way that the judge kind of sets up the case.
The tone, I tell
you. The tone, yeah. You know, just the way they describe the plaintiff. In a way, in like either favorable or unfavorable, you kind of know. But I don't bother with the body. I just go straight to the bottom.
Right.
And I see if I won or lost. And my heart's literally skipping a few beats as I go down to the bottom. And it's not just about the money. It's about wanting to win, right? And being concerned about losing and dreading the conversation with your client that, you know, they lost the case, which is not a fun conversation to have at all.
I'm sure.
So going to the bottom, finding, okay, we won. That's great. And then contacting the client. Usually I would call them on the phone right away. They'd be the first phone call I'd make and let them know the good news.
And how did that phone call go in this case?
It was good. You know, I think my client maybe had kind of forgotten about things because I think she wasn't even sure who I was. I called her up and she answers on the cell phone. She was driving and she answered, she said, "Hello." I'm like, "It's Paul." She's like, "Huh? Who?" I'm like, "Paul, your lawyer." She pause. "Oh, Paul. Oh, yeah." I'm like, "Don't you remember? We just did a trial 2 months ago, Siobhan. What are you?" And she's like, "Oh, okay. No, no, I remember now." And I was like, "We won." And she's like, "What?
Oh,
we won." She's like, "I can't believe it." Like, just in shock, you know? Like, but it's a great feeling. I think her husband was on speakerphone too. So it was a really nice moment.
Yeah.
The thing is in litigation, there's a 30-day appeal period, and the CMPA, the Association of Defense Physicians, they often appeal, right? It's not like there's a small chance. It's more like, well, we can kind of expect it. So as much as I like to give them the good news and say we won the trial, which is obviously great, I do tell them the defense now has 30 days, so let's, you know, keep the champagne on ice, right? And wait a bit and see if they appeal. And then after the 30 days, then we can celebrate. If they don't.
Yeah, good. That's good. So a little cautious celebration there.
Mm-hmm.
What, and I know perhaps once again you can't talk about the amount of damages here, but what was used to determine or calculate damages in this case? Or can you talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. So this lady had ongoing pain in her thigh, which had rendered her needing a cane to ambulate.
Oh, boy.
She was once quite an active lady.
At the age of what-ish?
So she, I think, was probably, she was 44 years old at the time of the surgery.
Oh, boy.
And so at the time of the trial, she was in her early 50s.
Mm.
She was active, and in the judgment, you'll see that she played recreational hockey.
Mm-hmm.
She was athletic and active.
Very active.
In her 40s and healthy. And was now required to walk with a cane to get around and had constant pain in her thigh. And it was neurogenic pain for sure. So she was taking, I think it was amitriptyline, which is a type of medication that's used to treat nerve pain.
Right.
Amongst other things. And so she was on prescription medication to treat a chronic pain disorder that had rendered her to require a cane to get around.
Mm.
Now, that was obviously very significant. However, she was able to work, she was able to drive, so she was able to do a lot of things. And so the case was a lot about what we'd call general damages, which is just a compensation for your pain and your suffering. And in Canada, there is a cap on how much pain and suffering damages a person can get. It's capped at about $350,000. It's indexed for inflation, so it's constantly going up. But the most anyone could ever get for pain and suffering damages is about $350,000. And that would usually be reserved for the most catastrophically of injured persons. When people say, well, in the States, I hear people get millions of dollars. Well, the reason why people can sometimes get millions of dollars is because in some states, there is no cap on general damages. And it's completely up to the jury to decide what amount of pain and suffering monetary damages a person should receive. And in some cases, and I think appropriately, people do think it should be in the millions of dollars because they do endure such significant pain and suffering damages. But just imagine, you know, a 44-year-old active woman playing hockey is now has chronic pain and walks with a cane. You know, what's that worth? Well, it's not worth $350,000 to play that as a matter of law. It's worth something less than that. So there was that component to her claim. There was some cost of care that was factored in that she may need in terms of treatment that would benefit her. And so that the cost of that was factored in as well. But that was how the case was assessed.
Got it. And hopefully, you know, again, for all the middle-aged women out there listening, the procedure itself was successful to relieve the stress incontinence.
Yeah, it worked. Yeah,
good.
It
did. Oh, good. Yeah. Good, good. You know, not that it makes that outcome any less devastating, and but certainly. So certainly that's so unfortunate. And I'm sure it hits close. I mean, we talked about this in the last case. This will strike close to the heart of a lot of women and doctors and families and potential patients. But because I'll just ask you a couple more questions because we want to get to one more trial, which I, you know, is kind of in my wheelhouse, which I'm really interested to talk to you about. But not that this hasn't been fascinating. I'm not saying that, but because the listeners include lawyers and healthcare people and the public, I ask you the same three questions about the last trial. What can be learned from this? Because I think there is no greater reason to share these stories and these outcomes from so many different perspectives because we all have something to learn. So for doctors, let's say, based on and OBGYNs or the people who perform this particular, is there anything that came up in this trial that you got a sense of, you know, that's just some practical common sense advice that would have served this, my client better or could have changed the outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was sort of an issue in this case, which I think does come up in operative cases is reconciling the outcome with the operative note.
Interesting.
How is it that the operative note, which seemed completely benign, produced an outcome which is almost never heard of?
Yeah, so let me ask you this quickly then. Was there anything, not just in the operative note, but in the post-operative care? Okay, so there's nothing in the operative note, but was there anything in the post-operative care that led anybody to suspect that this physician was aware that he or she had perhaps caused an injury? Like the
I think there was probably, you could infer that. I don't think the judge really got into it in her decision because it wasn't necessary to get into that.
Right.
And it was certainly consistent with a theory, and the theory that I presented to the court, and again, it doesn't really show up in the judgment, but that there may have been, and you know, our expert suggested this as well, that there may have been an unsuccessful attempt to place the trocar, which can happen, where a physician starts inserting the trocar, realizes that it's not quite ideally or properly aligned, so they pull it back and have a second attempt. Which would certainly explain how the injury could have happened and there would also, and yet still have a properly placed sling. Because if the physician actually went all the way out towards where the obturator nerve is and fastened the sling there, it would show that it wasn't properly placed. That no one disputed that it was in the proper place. So how is it that, you know, there could have been this lateral deviation and no evidence of it apart from the obturator nerve injury? And so, yeah, I think if you went in and had a little bit more of a closer analysis of the facts of this case, you could maybe argue that the physician himself, the defendant physician himself, may have been suspicious of this obturator nerve injury based on the test, based on the test that he was ordering, based on the conversations he was having with consulting services like the neurology service after the fact, but. Again, it didn't matter so much for the judgment whether there was that suspicion or not.
Right.
because of the way the case was decided. But yeah, I think, you know, what can we learn from this case? I think this particular case is a specific analysis of a surgical report that can't be reconciled with a surgical outcome. And this is not the first kind of case that you see. I mean, in doing legal research for this case, there are quite a number of cases similar to this, where you had a very benign operative report and a very unexpected outcome. And how does that make sense is the question.
And do you have a sense, an opinion or thought on how, if the operative report had accurately reflected a course of surgery that was consistent with the outcome, how would that have either changed your approach as the plaintiff's lawyer to the case, or perhaps strengthened the defense's position?
That's a great question. I think absolutely it probably would have strengthened the defense position, because I can hear my expert, Dr. Richard Casey, who I talked with many times leading up to this case, and hearing his sort of views and perspectives as they formulated his opinion that he testified to, that if the surgeon said, I made an attempt and I didn't feel that the placement was very good, so I pulled back and I made a second attempt, and at this time it was good, he might not have been my expert. He might have said to me, listen, Paul, you know what? Not below the standard of care to realize that you're not quite in the right spot. That is the standard of care.
Right.
To realize you're in the wrong spot and correct it.
Exactly. Exactly.
What's below the standard of care is to, you know, make that kind of mistake or go laterally when you're not supposed to, and then not tell anybody or document it.
Right.
That's not standard of care.
Right. And course correct. Okay. Well, that's good. So there's some interesting comment and advice for physicians there. What about lawyers? Because you certainly talked about the kind of backwards way standard of care versus causation that you had to litigate this case. Advice for lawyers that might be listening in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly it. When you're looking at a surgical case, you know, whenever I have a potential new client who has a bad surgical outcome, you know, you ask to see the operative note, you request it, and I can tell you 99% of the time it's going to read like how you'd expect the procedure to be performed if you looked at a textbook.
Right.
Like, so I don't expect there to be a smoking gun, sort of some recognition of some mistake or omission in the operative report. Sometimes there is, but more often than not, it reads like how the ideal procedure should be done. And actually, Dr. Casey, when he testified, and I'm sure this is in his transcript, talked about what is an operative report. And he didn't call it what happened. He called it the idealized version of what you hoped had happened, is what, you know, surgeons often dictate, the idealized version, not the actual version.
Right.
So as a lawyer, when you're analyzing these cases and trying to decide whether you want to pursue it, sometimes the operative note itself isn't enough. Sometimes you do have to work backwards from the outcome and have negligence inferred from the outcome, which is a scary topic, because we know from a legal perspective that can become contentious.
Sure.
Where the lawyers for the defense will say, oh, you can't infer negligence. Come on, you need direct evidence to prove negligence. Like,
right.
That's too important to, you know, be something you can infer. But you can, as a matter of law, you can. So if the outcome is really the kind of outcome that could not have happened in any other way, any other reasonable way than through negligence, and you have experts that will say that and testify to that fact, and it makes sense, it has to always make sense, then you probably have a good case.
Interesting. Very interesting. So all you lawyers out there listening up that have a question, and, you know, I'm sure Paul would be happy to co-counsel on you if you have cases that you're concerned. Am I right on that, Paul?
Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah, of course. And what about for the public? Is there a lesson from this injury, from the early days following the injury itself, or the management of the injury, the lawsuit? But I guess I'm thinking more about the injury itself. Is there a lesson here for the public? Middle-aged women with urinary stress incontinence in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned it a couple of times. I mean, this is a very, very common procedure and is performed.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these surgeries performed. Some are performed by urologists, some are performed by urogynecologists. But they're definitely very conversation, very safe and effective and recommended in certain circumstances. So this is definitely a, it's a bleep on the radar, right? That doesn't really happen very often. So I wouldn't, you know, as sort of a point, even though I practice in this area, and I guess because I do, I see a lot of medical malpractice, right? Because people are coming to me with concerns. I think we can't lose sight of the fact about how great our healthcare system is and how much it helps people.
Right.
And just because there is a risk of something bad happening, not necessarily because of negligence, but just, you know, sometimes you walk into a hospital and you come out worse than when you came in, and that's not really anyone's fault. Sometimes it is because of negligence, and it's such a, I think, a rare event that it's not something to be worried about.
Yeah. Thank you for reinforcing that, because I mean, there's nothing about this podcast that's meant to frighten anyone. I just think there's lessons to be learned for all of us in telling our stories. Mm. Well, do you have anything else you want to tell us about this particular trial, Paul?
No, I don't think so. I think that's it.
All right. Well, then let's call this podcast done. Thank you so much once again. Quick recap, I've been talking today with Paul Cahill regarding one of the malpractice trials that he ran last year. Paul is a partner in the law firm of Well Davidson in Toronto. If you are a patient who has questions or concerns about your medical care, or a lawyer who's looking for co-counsel on a medical malpractice case that you might need some advice on, Paul is open for phone calls and he's easy to find. Again, it's Paul Cahill from Well Davidson in Toronto. So we'll wrap that up for this podcast and be back with Paul on to hear about the third trial that he ran in the last 12 months. Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.